Welcome to our second of three nights in a row of seminars with John Stackhouse. Delighted that you're here, and I sense that there are several guests here, and we welcome you. We're so glad to have you here with us. I'm going to ask you to move in a little bit towards the center, because like last night, I know people will be coming in a little bit late, and if you could just move in a little bit to the center, then people can find their ways very easily on the outside, and they don't have to crawl over your lap. You know, that's Gloria doesn't want anybody crawling over her lap. Okay, so all right. This is not a church service. This is intended to be a seminar. Tonight the topic is Christianity and science. Christianity is bad because it is anti-scientific and also because it is responsible for science. What does that mean? Well, John Stackhouse is going to tell us. So delighted. Tomorrow night's topic. Last night we talked about Christianity and other faiths. Tomorrow night is going to be Christianity and the sexuality of the world. So we're delighted that John is here. We sense that you're excited for these challenging topics to be addressed. We invite you to give feedback to staff, other topics that you might want to explore as a church body or as a community living here in Cupertino. So we welcome that kind of feedback and input if you'd like to give that to us. We have, for the family at PBC, there's a box in the back. If you feel led to contribute to these seminars, we welcome that. No pressure at all. No pressure at all on guests. That's just for the family, Peninsula Bible Church here in Cupertino. So without further ado, I'm going to ask John to come on up and ask you to welcome him again.
Thank you, John. Good evening. If you have been enjoying these, and I have been enjoying them quite a bit, I would encourage you to think about next summer making that long trip up to Vancouver. Because as you may not know, Regent College runs the biggest Christian summer school in the world. And we've been running it for about 40 years, and we try to make it as user-friendly as possible. We run courses in May and June, and then again in July and August. Most of the courses are 1 week long. Some of them are only 2 weeks long, and we meet only in the classes meet either in the mornings or the afternoons, so you have the rest of the day off if you want to. My parents came every year that they were retired, because they got to listen to some good teaching, and they got to see the grandkids, and they got to enjoy Vancouver. And they were smart enough to audit, which meant they paid less and didn't do any homework. So that's a real option for you, is to pay the reduced audit fee, come up and listen to the teaching. But if you do come up and want to do it for graduate school credit, Regent is a graduate college of the University of British Columbia, you can come up and you can still have a lot of fun, because you don't do any homework while you're there. You get to enjoy the area and get to enjoy the free lectures we have in the evenings and the concerts we run at noon hour. And then you've got 45 days to do your homework and mail it in to your examiner. So think about that if you haven't before. I mean, a lot of us don't think about summer school, because summer school is for the bad kids, right? The ones who didn't pay attention, or maybe the grinders are trying to get ahead, but it's not that kind of summer school. I mean, Regent is a rigorous graduate school, but frankly, summer school is really summer camp for grown-ups. So you think about coming up and take a look at our website. We'll have our new courses and offerings coming up probably September, October on the website. And I've been put in charge of summer school for next year, so I'm going to make sure it's interesting, because I have to be there. So I'm inviting all my friends to come. Let me talk to you tonight about this interesting and, as you can see, vexed question about Christianity and science. And I want to suggest that Christians, when it comes to science, are in a kind of double bind. Christianity as a religion and the Christian church as an institution have been, currently are, and intrinsically shall always be inimical to science. This is a myth that is abroad in the land. It's been kind of common coin among intellectuals and university people for over 100 years, particularly in America, but elsewhere as well, that Christianity simply is antithetical to the scientific mind. But since the 1960s, especially with the influential work of Lynn White and others, we learned that the Christian outlook, which has dominated Western culture, has given humans permission to mistreat nature via science and technology in the name of human dominion over the earth, as in Genesis 1 and 2. So, I say this as a Christian, I'm thrilled to report that Christianity is bad, both because it's inimical to science and because it is the legitimation of science. Okay, you see the problem? It's two problems. Christianity is bad because it isn't scientific enough, and it's bad because it's too scientific. So we will proceed to deal with these two questions in order tonight, and then, as usual, we'll have some time for questions and answers and lavish compliments to the speaker a little bit later. Those are the only three categories. Actual disagreement is for someone else. Okay, first, three reasons to believe that science and Christianity are indeed compatible. Now, you know, this is a bright audience, this is Cupertino. You know that I have, in a sense, an impossible task tonight, right? Of course, the relationship of Christianity and science is huge and interesting and complex, but what we're going to try to do is what we can do in one talk. I try to make things simple without being simplistic. As Einstein said, to try to simplify as far as possible, but no farther. And you're welcome to criticize what I say as being simplistic or as being off the mark or I've forgotten something. I'll want to learn from you about that. I don't pretend to think that this is infallible stuff, but these are ways of looking at this that help me. And they're pretty simple, but I think they're also useful for us. So three reasons to believe that science and Christianity are indeed compatible, that they aren't intrinsically antithetical or combating each other. First, here's one reason to think that science and Christianity can somehow go together. The empirical evidence that scientists actually believe in God and the Christian God. Like, I'm just pointing to the fact that's well documented that lots of scientists are also Christians. Now, you might say that's kind of commonplace, but it's actually a significant point. If science and Christianity were inimical, then you wouldn't have any scientists who were Christians, except for perhaps a few psychological cripples who are clinging to the faith of mom and dad for whatever reason, or they've had tragedy in life, or they're psychologically deranged, and so they're clinging to religion despite their science. But in fact, lots and lots of people who are well-trained in science, technology, engineering, and so on, believe in the Christian God. So not just a few, but lots of scientists. This is one of the things I find kind of sweet and pathetic about Richard Dawkins when he writes about this, is that he actually knows there are a few really good scientists, indisputably good scientists from his point of view, who are Christian. And he can name three. I was thinking, you got to get out more, you know. You got to wander around Oxford more than you do, and maybe go to the other place, wander around there, and maybe go up to London from time to time. And over here in America, there are a few more, you know, million scientists who are Christians as well without their brains exploding. You know, somehow they're able to do that. Lots and lots of scientists are Christians. And this has been true since the scientific revolution, when most, in fact, of the leading lights of the scientific revolution were church-going Christians. I mean, most of the people from the 17th century, who are the famous people in the textbooks, from Galileo Galilei, Tycho Brahe, Johannes Kepler, Isaac Newton himself. Now, some of them had fairly wacky religious ideas. Isaac Newton was a nobody's idea of a regular Sunday school teacher. He had some pretty outlandish religious views, but all of them saw themselves as Christians, went to church as Christians, and in their private papers continued to express this piety. I mean, sometimes when I say this, I have people come back and say, well, everybody in the 17th century had to say they were Christians, or what? You know, maybe they were going to be burned at the stake, which is just not true. I mean, that's taking your history from Monty Python, actually, rather than from actual history books. So no, they weren't going to be burned at the stake, and Galileo's trouble with the Catholic Church had a lot to do with Galileo, as well as with the Catholic Church. But they're just, what about Galileo? Well, name three more. Like, name 10 more, 20 more. Like, there's something special about the Galileo situation, which we can't get into tonight, but it's not as if all these Christians were false and were, secretly Dawkinsian atheists. It's just not true. So we could stop there and simply say, apparently, millions of people are able to be scientific and Christian. and we're done, and now we can go for coffee. But since I came all the way from Vancouver, I'll give you another reason besides this. Secondly, it seems to me science and Christianity are in fact compatible by definition. So let's do some defining. Well, what do we mean by science? Originally in the Latin, scientia is simply the word for knowledge, generally. And then we see the idea of science refracted into a disciplined pursuit of knowledge. Not just knowledge in general, but knowledge that is gained by the disciplined or organized, rigorous investigation of the world, what the Germans call Wissenschaft. And then an even narrower definition emerges, which is the version we tend to use today when we mean by science, and that is knowledge that is gained by the scientific method per se, and hence the natural sciences and the social sciences are these particular disciplines at the university that pursue knowledge according to the so-called scientific method. Okay, so that's what I mean by science, is what knowledge that's pursued according to the scientific method. And what are we talking about when we talk about Christianity and God more generally? Well, we don't mean God in general. We don't mean anybody's definition of God. There's all sorts of definitions of God around the world, and many of them are perfectly compatible with science because they have almost nothing to do with science. In the Chinese context, it could be Tian or the Tao, or in the Indian context, it could be Brahman, defined various ways. There's just really no big problem with that. The problem, as it's emerged, has to do with this monotheistic deity, this one and only one God, and particularly the Abrahamic God, the God that is at the center of the Jewish and Christian and Muslim religions. So that's what we mean by God and science, and then Christianity even more specifically. So if we're talking about science as knowledge that's pursued by the scientific method, and we're talking about Christianity as this religion based on this kind of a God who's revealed himself particularly in Jesus Christ, where's the conflict? The sciences describe aspects of the world in a particular disciplined way. That's what they do. And from the Christian point of view, God made the world and made us and the rest of the world such that much about the world is scientifically intelligible. Right? The reason that sciences work, the reason we pursue them, is that the world is the kind of place in which scientific methods actually yield knowledge. I mean, it might not. You think, well, what are you talking about? Well, if you're in a dream, the scientific method's not maybe going to help you very much because you can't predict what's going to happen next. And in a dream, the rules that govern these 5 minutes don't govern the next 5 minutes. And up can be down, and heavy can be light, right? And dark can be light. I mean, anything can happen in a dream. And if we were in a world that was not, in fact, so stably predictable as ours, science would be useless. But in fact, we do have that kind of a world. And God has actually made us also as the kinds of creatures that can perceive the world in that way. I mean, other creatures perceive the world too. All the other creatures perceive the world, but we're made such that we can perceive the world in the scientific way and therefore draw reasonably reliable knowledge from it. That's the way God has made us right from Genesis 1, where God calls human beings to garden the world. God creates us in God's image to be creative gardeners, keepers, lords of the world. And to do that properly, to be a good gardener, you have to have reasonably reliable scientific knowledge of your garden, right? You need to be able to know that if you add this to the soil, that's going to happen. And if you take that from the soil, this is going to happen. And if you add this much water, you're going to get this result. And if you add too much water or not enough water, this is going to happen. To garden properly, you need to live in a kind of scientifically ordered environment and have a scientific cast of mind. In this broad sense, according to the scientific method, in order to farm it well. And that's the way God has made us and the world. What I'm doing under the second point, then, is simply saying that from the Christian view of things, science is not only easily compatible, it's even required in a basic sense. Like, you can't do what God calls us to do unless you have, in some important sense, a scientific outlook. So I'm suggesting that there's no prima facie conflict between following science and believing in the Christian view of things. Now, that didn't take very long to explain, right? I didn't go too fast. It's kind of disappointing, even. Like, that's like, in fact, some of you, if you're staying appropriately skeptical, and you should, you say, not only was that pretty quick and pretty easy, it's almost too easy, right? How did he just dispense with the Christianity and science problem in like 5 minutes? How did that happen? Is it a magician? Did he put something up his sleeves, or is there something else coming? Well, there is something else going on, but I don't think it's that. I mean, I honestly do think that that's that. That the Christian worldview, compared to other religious and philosophical worldviews, is easily compatible with science. It just is. So why is there so much storm and stress around religion and science? Which there is. Like, what's all this smoke about? If there's all this smoke, isn't there a fire somewhere? Well, yes, there are actually two or three fires burning, but it's not this one, in my view. It's not Christianity versus science as being somehow antithetical. Among the things I think most centrally at stake is the rationality of theism. Are there actually good reasons to believe in God? And the answer is yes, there are. But that's the question, is that I think a friend of mine who is not a theist could look at this and say, yes, I can see the compatibility, conceptually speaking, of those first two propositions. I just don't believe the second proposition. And I don't think there's any good reason to believe the second proposition. Well, okay, but now we're having a different kind of argument, is my point. Now it's not that Christianity can't possibly be squared with science. The problem is that Christianity is probably not true. But that's a different question. You with me on this? And that's a question in which Christians are pretty comfortable. We've been arguing for the truth of Christianity for a couple thousand years, and we've got a few good arguments along the way to justify why Christians actually believe that Christianity is true. So I'm suggesting that science and belief in God are also compatible, because I think there are rational, scientifically respectable reasons to believe in God. Now, I'm not going to overclaim. I'm going to be trying to be very careful not to overclaim or overpromise. I don't think that the evidence and the reasons to believe in God are so powerful that any intelligent person would simply have to comply with them and become a Christian. I think that'd be very cool if that were the case, and I could quit my current job and go and convert the entire world. But so far, I haven't found those, so I'm going to go back and, you know, earn my living in Vancouver like I usually do. I don't think there are such reasons. But there are, in fact, and there have been, in fact, for centuries, sensible reasons to believe in God. And that's where the argument really lies. The argument, in other words, does not lie in the very definition of science and the definition of Christian theism as if there's some kind of basic conflict. There isn't. Now, in a more detailed way is the third answer. Because some of you who've been involved in these debates, whether you're a Christian or you're not, and if you're a Christian, glad to have you here tonight. If you're not, you're equally welcome. What else is burning here? And it's this. The question as to whether the Christian religion actually explains anything that science can't. The real question for a lot of thoughtful people here is not whether theoretically you can put together Christianity and science. It's why you would bother. Because you don't need Christianity to explain things when you have a scientific view of the world. You can explain everything that needs explaining simply on the grounds of natural and social science. And because I'm a Canadian, I have to include some French. It's the law when we travel. So this is from the great Enlightenment thinker. Je n'ai pas besoin de cette hypothèse. Okay, what Laplace is saying when as the story goes, he's presenting his book of science to the emperor, and the emperor of France says to him, well, I see there's no mention of God here. And he says, I have met your majesty, I have no need of that hypothesis. Right? I can explain everything I need to explain without having to refer to God, so why would I bother? So let's talk about that, because that to me is among the more interesting and challenging areas of discussion as contemporary North Americans. And to talk about this, let me set up a little bit in terms of framework, the hierarchy of disciplines and the question of adequate explanation. Does that sound appropriately professorial? Yeah? Yeah. Okay, you would have been disappointed if you didn't get to see something like that. Okay, well, check this out. Okay, we're going to build up, in a sense, by disciplines. I'm going to leave some of them out. Sorry, no offense to those of you who are subspecialists in, you know, plasma, geophysical, bio, blood chemistry, or whatever the hell you do. It's great. But these are, in sort of basic terms, the point here is that the way we look at the world, according to our academic disciplines or intellectual disciplines, move up. As I said, they build on each other. At the most elementary level, we've got physics. And we can explain, as it were, we can explain the whole universe in terms of physics. And you can stop there. But we don't feel that that's an adequate explanation. We can actually explain everything that happens in the universe by the simple interaction of matter and energy according to a variety of laws and rules, some of which we've figured out, some of which we haven't. But we don't feel satisfied with that, and we feel that we should instead talk about chemistry. And that takes us to another order of explanation where we start looking at chemical interactions, because that seems interesting to us as well. But when we actually want to study life and the way living organisms are, we don't want to settle, as it were. There's a sense in which to explain living creatures only in terms of their physics and chemistry is to miss something. So we press the right button on our computer and we come up with biology. And so the natural sciences build. People who want to study biology go to university and they find, sometimes to their cost, that they have to study physics and chemistry. And they wanted to study biology. But they have to do more physics and chemistry so that they can do better in biology, but they don't find that biology is simply physics and chemistry. There's kind of value added at that level of explanation. And as we move up into the social sciences, we have the psychology of individuals and the sociology of group interaction. And the social sciences, when we get to human beings, we don't settle for studying the way humans act in terms of physics. You know, as if they're just simply bodies bumping into each other in space. And chemistry, that's not enough. Although it's interesting, it's part of it. Biology is not enough, although that's interesting and it's part of it. And psychology is interesting, but that's only part of it. And then sociology helps us paint a much richer, broader picture. And the sense is that if you stop too soon, you're not explaining everything that needs to be explained. You can, in a sense, explain things at a lower level. And if somebody is what we might call a physics fundamentalist, he could say, everything that needs to be explained can be described in terms of physical interaction. And you say, yes, but you're not really getting at a lot of stuff that we can just intuit is important if you stop at the physical or the chemical level. Let me just stop there for a minute. If you, for instance, are on a date, and this isn't a first date for you, this is a date fairly far down the line, and depending on your sexual ethics, you know, could be quite far down the line, could be fairly early, but you're ready now to get fairly hot and heavy in your making out, okay? And I know that there are people of certain ages here, so I don't want to offend those of you who are older. The kids all know about this. It's you. They're uncomfortable, but I'm uncomfortable too, but because I know what I'm going to say. But if you're on a date and it's a romantic date and there's strong, shall we say, romantic attraction between you, and you start to make your pitch, as it were, that things should heat up. We're in this lovely spot, and there's moonlight over the water, and there's no one else around, and we've had a lovely evening together, and why don't we celebrate our love by, and so on and so on. Which, for me, when I was dating, would culminate in a kiss, and then I would just be so excited we had to go home. Which I'm sure is true for young people today. As I have three boys in their 20s, that's what I prefer to think, and I don't want to hear that it might be otherwise from any of you spoil sports, okay? So we have this romantic attraction, and we're working our way up to a kiss. And I decide that what I think will really seal the deal with the woman that I'm moving in on is to describe what's happening in terms of biochemistry. Right now, you're having a cascade of hormones into your bloodstream, and I begin to describe. Well, there's not going to be another date, right? There's a sense in which things have been reduced too low on the hierarchy of disciplines, that above the social and natural sciences, there needs to be something like history and literature and art. There needs to be something more human than that, and we need to be up in the realm of the humanities. And when I'm in that situation, I'm not supposed to get biochemical, I'm supposed to get poetical, right? Or there's not going to be another date. And it's not that the poetry of romance has nothing to do with the cascade of chemicals, has nothing to do with the amygdala kicking in, has nothing to do with pheromones in the air. It has to do with all that, but if we reduce it to that, we have the sense that we've reduced it too far, that there's stuff that still needs to be explained. And as we move up, we realize that above... it's the problem is you buy these cheap computers and... And history and literature and art deal wonderfully with particulars, right? History is what particularly happened, and literature is a particular story, and art is a particular artistic expression. And then we move up to the philosophical subdisciplines, which help us to generalize and about things in general as we move up through the humanities. And finally, we get to the top level, which is where we put theology or religion or philosophy of life, that sort of comprehensive worldview, and we feel that at that level, there is something to be said. Now, notice that I put all three of them up there because Richard Dawkins and I are both up at that top level. In other words, I don't think that he necessarily needs theology or religion. I think he already has a religion, functionally speaking. His outlook, his general worldview is his religion. It's his organizing core. And I don't mean anything sly or cheeky by that. I'm just saying that functionally, he has a worldview, and so do I. My worldview happens to be a proper noun religion, Christianity, so we normally call that theology or religion, and his might be scientific materialism, but it's up there too. Okay, so everybody has something at the top level, and we all feel that it's appropriate to have that. Like, we naturally have that because that's our big map within which there are all these other maps embedded. So the point is that complete description at one level does not necessarily exhaust meaningful description at another level. I mean, it might, but it might not. There's no reason to go up the hierarchy if you're not gaining anything by that. So some things are simply physical interactions, and they're just physics. And there is nothing interesting to say about them chemically. So you just stop, and they're physics, okay? And so on. And some things are just physics and chemistry, and there's nothing biological going on, so you don't bother bringing in biology. And there's certainly nothing psychological or sociological going on, so there's no reason to go up. It's not necessarily, in other words, better to go up. No reason to talk about theology and religion in particular unless you have to. Okay? So even though I'm a Christian, I don't feel that I have to be Christian about everything I'm doing, because there's nothing really Christian about solving my math problems. Boy, I wonder what Christian long division would look like. You know? Well, it involves more crosses and fish. Well, no, it's just math. And as you move up and you're doing engineering, there may not be a Christian way to do that. It's just good engineering and so on, right? So even though you're a Christian all the time, while you're doing that, you're not doing anything distinctively Christian. You're just doing human things as you move up that level. So complete description at one level, on the one hand, doesn't necessarily exhaust meaningful description at another level, but it might. So it just depends. Are we, in any given situation, describing things at the level of maximum useful description? That's the question we want to have whenever we're trying to decide how to talk about things. So what about talking about these ancient great categories of the world, the true, the good, and the beautiful? Because my contention is that Christianity adds value to the intellectual portrait of the world, that science and Christianity have no intrinsic problem with each other, but Christianity adds something to the description of the world that science cannot supply, which is why I'm a Christian as well as a scientific person. Okay, that's where I would need to go. But I have to show that. I can't just assert it. I have to actually demonstrate it. So let's invert the order to begin where I think science seems obviously least helpful, and then we'll move to where it seems to be so helpful we may not need Christianity at all. Okay, so we start with the true, the good, and the beautiful. We'll invert the order, and we'll start with the beautiful and go for the good and then the true. You with me so far? Okay. And this is where, now that I've been speaking for about a half an hour, I've now talked you into a certain kind of compliance. So this is where I bring forward my most controversial points while you're all lulled into a comfortable doldrum. So just let my rich baritone voice wash over you and just sleep comfortably as I speak. Okay. So what about beauty? Is beauty just a tool of species or genes to further reproduction? In other words, can we explain the phenomenon of beauty in a strictly sociobiological way? That what we're perceiving as beauty is just the human version of being attracted to things that are there, not because there's anything intrinsically beautiful in them, not because they are beautiful, but because they have certain patterns or shapes or smells and so on that are selectively advantageous to the organisms that have them, so that the flowers attract the bees and so on, right? Is that all beauty is a kind of happy accident of the natural selection of species in order to have reproductive advantage? Is that all there is? Can we reduce things to that kind of scientific level? Well, let's do a little test. I mean, is there really, in your view, intuitively, is there really no difference between this and this? Now, I think I can see a difference right away. And apparently, you can too. I mean, is everything, in fact, equally beautiful? Or do we want to say that? Or do we want to say that beauty is really in the eye of the beholder? I mean, in this case, you just have to have blind eyes to think that those are the same. Like, it's, you know, like your eyes can function at all. I mean, she's not bad looking, but still. All right, moving on. Does science, in fact, adequately explain this aspect of life? That's the question we're saying. Do we really think that beauty is nothing more than, nothing but that? Now, Christians are inclined to adore God and to enjoy relationship with God, and some of our new atheist friends, like Mr. Dawkins, will say, we don't need all that supernatural mumbo-jumbo. There's wonder enough in the world. Why can't we just look at what's beautiful and just enjoy that? But why would you settle for admiring the woman's beauty when you can actually get to know the woman herself? And I'm saying, why settle? Of course there's lots of beauty and wonder in the world. There's beauty in mathematics. There's beauty in science of all sorts. Of course there's lots of beauty there. But if, in fact, there is a designer behind that, wouldn't it be kind of cool to know the artist as well as enjoy the art? I mean, if there's no artist there, then it's foolish to go hunting for him. But if there is, it would be sad to miss out. So the question's open. Is there evidence that there's more here than simply, in the case of beauty, certain kinds of pleasing patterns and colors and so on that happen to trigger in us certain kinds of behaviors? In fact, in the case of the human perception of beauty, what possible selective advantage can there be to being able to distinguish between girl with a pearl earring and my portrait? Like, that doesn't seem to be selectively advantageous, but aren't you glad you can tell the difference? What about the good? To, again, focus our discussion because it's of an evening, we only have a certain amount of time. I want to ask this question. Does altruism actually exist? And if so, why? Altruism is the sense of sacrificing something on behalf of somebody else and wanting their good, even at the expense of yourself. That's what I mean by altruism, is sacrificing something of my own in order to advantage somebody else. Does that actually exist? And if so, why would it exist? So we're talking about the good. And the question is, does altruism exist? I'm using this as an example of what we would tend to call, most of us, good behavior, morally praiseworthy behavior and feelings and so on. Now, sometimes in discussions like this, the question has been, can people be good without God? And you may have heard that question. Can we be good without God? And a lot of my atheist friends rightly take umbrage at that, because they're pretty sure the Christian's going to say no, and then they'll say, well, actually, I think I am pretty good, thank you very much. And I can point to lots of other people who don't seem to have your religious faith or any kind of religious faith, and they seem to be manifestly pretty good as well. And they're right about that. The question is not whether people happen to be or can be good without God in some sense. Now, although to sincerely and knowledgeably reject God from a Christian point of view is by definition to be not good. But still, having added that rider and also appreciating that lots of people in my acquaintance, and perhaps yours as well, are at a stage of their own journey where they are rejecting God, but what they're really rejecting is mom or dad or the church or the abusive pastor or the young life leader who hit on them or something. Like they're rejecting a whole harmful, hurtful package, and God's caught up in that, and they're maybe going to have to find their way to God later on. So I think what I mean by the parenthetical phrase is, as God sees it, as God actually knows their hearts, if they are in fact truly rejecting God, then they're in big trouble from a Christian point of view. But if they seem to be rejecting God, they may not be. They may just be wrestling with God. And I want to make that really important distinction, okay? Fair enough? But the question is not really whether people happen to be or can be good without God. Lots of our neighbors are gooder than we are. And I think that's just obvious. And I've never been persuaded by the line of Christian ethical thinking that goes back quite a long ways that says, well, if it can appear good, but if it's not really directed toward God, it's not good at all. Even Augustine can sound like that sometimes, and I just think he's wrong about that. I just think that when some human being helps a child in distress, that's a good thing, whether they actually know the name of God or intend to honor God or not. I think it's a manifestly good thing. Why? Because it's doing what human beings were called to do in Genesis 1. It's making shalom in the world. And I think we tie ourselves in ethical knots not to, in a sense, celebrate the obvious. But the question tonight is whether people are or can be coherently good without God. In other words, yes, people can be good and are good, but are they good in a way that actually coheres with their philosophy or worldview? Or are they better than their own ideas? Can they actually, from their philosophy of life, adequately ground, warrant, defend, explain why they're so good? That's the question. In terms of motivation, why be good? And in terms of definition, what is good? I'm engaged right now in a long Facebook argument with an acquaintance of mine who was raised a Pentecostal Christian and then went to university and began to lose his faith in the old story. And he has a PhD in the sociology of religion. He's a very clever guy, and he's become a kind of Dawkinsian, scientistic kind of person. And he and I are arguing about this right now because he thinks that morality in general and altruism in particular can be entirely explained in terms of kinship concerns. In other words, I'm good to other people because evolution has selected us the trait of being nice to people we meet, because primitively all the people you met were probably people of your kin group. And so it was selectively advantageous to be nice to the people you met, because they're probably all your cousins and they're all part of the same tribe, and we'll all do better if we all cooperate. And now that another bunch of years of evolution has taken place, now we can actually see something on TV and we start caring for a child far away, and we feel this pang of concern, even though that child's not part of our kinship group and can't really help us. And this is kind of our originally helpful view. Well, what's happened? And this is the argument. I'm saying, why would we have this concern for what I'm calling the distant stranger who can't possibly help me propagate my genes, right? Who can't possibly... It's one thing for me to give my life for my kids, because from this Darwinian point of view, that's a good thing to do, right? Because if they survive, the genes continue, my fate in genetic history continues, all that's good. But why would I be good in an altruistic way, even a self-sacrificial way, even taking money from my kids and giving it to the distant stranger, which I do, and my kids know that I do that, and they're Christian enough to think that's all right. because they have the same delusion I do, that that is something we should do, even though they need the money, and I don't have extra money. But that makes sense from a Christian point of view. I don't think it makes sense from a Darwinian point of view. Or even to say, as I say, definition, what is good? Can scientific morality even be morality? Or have we, in fact, simply been playing with words? Because from what I understand from reading Dawkins and others, they really actually don't believe in altruism. There is no actual such thing as altruism. If you read The God Delusion and you read this chapter on altruism, he presents six different books, all of which argue an explanation of altruism that really amounts to saying no one really is selfless. Altruism, in fact, doesn't exist. It's really selfish behavior modulated through some other way. And I say, well, okay, that's one way of explaining this behavior, but I kind of think that doesn't explain not only people like me who give a certain amount of money to the distant stranger, but the people throughout history who have left their comfortable homes and lived with the distant strangers and given their lives in non-propagative missionary work, childless missionary work, in a culture where they are almost guaranteed not to get married and have kids. And people do that all the time and have been doing it for hundreds of years, whether it's medical work or it's educational work or it's Peace Corps work. People do that all the time. Now, from a Darwinian point of view, that seems worse than crazy. It actually seems like a counterproductive thing to do. I, in my view, am just simply asking you, is a scientific morality even a morality? Or is, in fact, morality just being collapsed from what you ought to do to simply what you do do? And my friend is basically trying to tell me that the conflict I feel between looking after my kids and looking after these distant strangers is just my Darwinian programming that's kind of a little out of whack. And I would say, but you know, but lots of people have this strangely unproductive inclination. And that, I think, to be consistent, is why Dennett and Dawkins and others feel that Christians are actually positively dangerous, because we do seem to often do things that are not selectively advantageous. Well, I have to ask you, is that the way you want to look at the world? Does that make sense to you? Does science adequately explain this aspect of life? I'm underlining adequately again, because they do offer an explanation. It's not like they can't say anything. It's just at the end of the day, I have to tell you, I don't want to settle for that. Their explanation of altruism strikes me as subhuman and really disappointing and pretty dark. So I hope there's a good reason that I don't have to believe that everyone who's ever been kind to me was really doing it in order to advantage themselves. Well, then what about the truth? What about just explaining the way the world is? Surely science is on its strongest, most comprehensive grounds here. But let me pick two or three zones, big zones, of explanation, and see if a scientistic view of the world, a view that confines itself only to the natural and social sciences, will really do the job. Let's look at human history. Why have people done what they have done? And does it all mean anything? Maybe it doesn't. Maybe it's all sound and fury, signifying nothing. But if you have a sense that there had been glorious epochs in human civilization, if you believe that some of the artwork generated by cultures around the globe are truly praiseworthy and deserving of celebration and enjoyment, if you believe that some people have done morally praiseworthy things and aesthetically and politically and economically praiseworthy things, if you think it actually means something, you have a real hard time defending that on strictly scientific grounds, especially in the grounds of this sociobiological Darwinian view of things, which is the way that the new atheists typically explain them. Really? Why have people done what they've done? Does it all mean anything? Let's pick another really big zone. Religion. Why do most people believe in something more than mere matter and energy in motion? And why do people in particular believe in the supernatural, and even more particularly in God? Like, where's the selective advantage in that? Why would people, so many people, continue to believe in this? And as some of you know who are here Sunday morning, I was reading some passages from Darwin and from Nietzsche, and they actually will confess from time to time honest puzzlement to the point of dismay that so many people continue to believe this stuff. Because it seems manifestly crazy and even dangerous. Why would so many people do that? That's a really good question. Why do so many people believe that? Are they all stupid? I mean, you might say, do religious people believe their religion because they're dumb? Well, some of them are, you know? I mean, I've been around religious people my whole life, and I can assure you some of them are dumb. So that may be why. Or are some of them evil? Yep, some of them are evil too. Are some of them crazy? Yes, sadly, some of them are. But I really can't bring myself to think that all 2 billion Christians can have their religious affiliation explained by simply a lack of intelligence or a lack of morality or a lack of mental hygiene. Like really? Like all 2 billion of them are too stupid to follow the arguments of new atheism or are too psychologically crippled to let go of daddy God or that? I mean, really, are they all like that? And you can, I think those of you who know this literature, no, I'm not exaggerating. I mean, that is the way Hitchens and Dawkins and Dennett speak. Like really, these are pathetic people and there seem to be so distressingly many of them. Like, how can that be? But here's the more penetrating question, I think. You see, from a Christian point of view, I can explain atheists, but I don't think atheists can explain me. And all over, for my whole career, I've had bright, well-educated journalists come and interview me because I'm supposed to be the university professor. And you know that when you see a university professor in a news story, on TV or in the newspaper, we're supposed to play a particular role, right? The journalist knows what she wants to say, she does her filming, she sets up the story, and then she goes to a compliant university professor, has us validate whatever it is she wants, and we come on for a minute, you know, John Stackhouse in his office here at the university, blah, 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 says, and I go, blah, 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 says, yes, exactly what we thought, and then we carry on. Why? Why can they do that? Because all right-thinking people think the same way. And I cannot tell you how many interviewers have stumbled over their scripts when they found out that the university professor didn't agree with all right-thinking people. And they'll actually stop and ask the question again in exactly the same words as if I'm a slow child. Without any prep, they know what I'm supposed to say because I have a University of Chicago PhD, and they know that I have published several books with university presses, and they know that I have been promoted through a secular university system, and I've won a dozen research awards, so of course I think like them. I've got all these secular credentials. Don't all smart people think the same way? And I've had the number of them. Once the lights shut down and the microphones are turned off, I've said to them, say, you actually seem to believe this. Well, I do. Really? Yes, I do. Really? Like everything we talk, yeah, I do. You actually go to church? Yep, yeah, I do. Pretty much every Sunday. Really? Yep. You know, I had a roommate like you. This is a direct quote from a Canadian television reporter. In fact, she was kind of like you. She was kind of smart and she was fun to be with. I enjoy talking to her. Now that's two. Is rocking her world. But there's a lot of us. I can explain atheists, but I find it interesting that they seem to have real difficulty explaining us. And what about even science itself? Can science provide the grounds for itself as an avenue to truth? That is, can a scientistic outlook even explain why science works so well? See, earlier I told you why Christianity says science will work so well. I told you that Christianity grounds science. It says God has made the world and he's made human beings such that he wants us to administer the world. And there's no way you can do that unless you have a certain intellectual purchase on the world. Ergo, science naturally emerges out of a Christian context. And as a historian, I'm here to tell you, and guess where science emerged? I mean, there's technology and a certain amount of observation of nature in the wonderful ancient civilizations of India and China and Japan and elsewhere, but science doesn't emerge until the Christian civilization of Europe. And historians have been arguing about this for 100 years or so as to why this happened and whether it happened and so on. But it seems to me fairly obvious it does, because the affinity is obviously there. So Christianity provides grounds for science. But can Darwinian evolutionary scientism ground science? And to collapse a big discussion into a very small one, I'm suggesting that this is the question they have to answer. Why would it be selectively advantageous to be able to formulate accurate accounts of evolution? That's the question. Why would it be selectively advantageous for human beings to be able to come up with the theory of evolution? Is that a little bit too abstract? Let me put it a little more directly. Cover your kids' ears, okay? How is a Darwinian who forms accurate understandings of the world more likely to get laid than if he doesn't? That's, in a sense, the question, right? That's what the euphemism of selectively advantageous means, is reproductive advantage. So is it your experience that scientists who are able to more accurately understand the physical world than others get more girlfriends? That's not been mine. Now, maybe in Cupertino, it's true. But that's simply because they're hoping that this guy's going to end up at Apple. Not necessarily about having a big scientific brain. So that's the honest question, is that why would evolution have selected this giant cerebrum that would then be able to formulate theories about evolution, and why would we trust that the theory we have is actually true rather than sexually advantageous, which is what evolution selects for? Evolution does not select for truth-seeking unless truth-seeking is selectively or reproductively advantageous. See what I'm saying? So that's an honest question to which I have not yet gotten a very good answer. I've gotten some, but not very good answers. And I'm just wondering about that. Again, it seems to me that science explains some aspects of life, but not all of them. So by way of conclusion, if we're going to have this view of humanity as being simply this product of impersonal evolutionary forces that have produced this powerful planet-dominating species that is more reproductively advantageous reproductively successful than others, is this really the way we want to look at the world? You can't explain it that way. I'm saying, is this adequate? Is this an adequate and satisfying explanation? This is not just my conclusion, because I've got the second question to answer, right? Which I'm going to answer much more briefly, you'll be pleased to know. But this is actually a poem called The Conclusion by an English author named Steve Turner. "My love," she said, "after all's considered, we're only machines. I chained her to my wall for future use." And she cried. So I think we can celebrate science together. We can notice its limitations. We can look for rational explanations for what science alone doesn't and can't explain. And theism and Christianity in particular offers explanations which we then can criticize and say, are they rational? Are they the best we can find? And maybe we can do better than Christianity. But I am suggesting that Christianity does at least offer ways of seeing the true, the good, and the beautiful that strike me at least as being superior to settling for a scientific understanding of things. Okay? So that's the end of part one. And part two is going to come much more quickly. And I know we've got a time for questions and answers in a bit. But why don't we take one more 60-second break, and then we'll go into the second question about Christianity and ecological responsibility. So let's talk about why Christianity and ecological responsibility are, in fact, compatible. I mean, that's what you'd expect somebody from Vancouver to be able to say, right? And of course they are. Gave all the trees on our property a nice hug before I came down. Christians have as the guiding principles, among those guiding principles, what I've been talking about already in terms of what we call the cultural commandment or the cultural mandate from Genesis 1 and 2, to cultivate the world. This is what God calls human beings to do, to be fruitful, to multiply, to fill the earth, and subdue it, Now, this is a very strange set of verbs. For one thing, God normally doesn't waste precious Bible time commanding human beings to do what they're jolly well going to do anyway. So the first commandment in the Bible is have sex. And you'd think that's kind of redundant. But it's odd. I mean, that's the first thing God says, is be fruitful. I mean, if they told me this in Sunday school, I would have paid a lot more attention. You know? The youth group attended to be, don't have sex, don't have it. It's the most beautiful, fabulous thing in the world, and you, no one can have it except people in marriage, and even then. Okay. But, sorry, I let the secret out. Sorry, married people, sorry. Okay. So God says, be fruitful, have a kid, multiply, have a lot of kids, fill the earth. That's a lot of kids. Why? So that you can subdue the earth. That's a very strong verb. It's the verb that a king uses to respond to a country. He subdues it. Why? Because when God creates the world, he doesn't create it perfect. When God creates the world, he doesn't say, now, that's perfect. What does he say it is? Not just good, it's very good, but it's not perfect. See, if you get a paper back from me and it says very good on it, right? There's no A with that. It's just very good. It's one of those disappointing B's. Now, what's going on here? Because God has created a world as a kind of studio for us to paint in and to sculpt in. It's not perfect. When you have something that's perfect, my wife and I moved into a house in North Vancouver a few years ago, and we'd been, you know, students and poor academic couple for a long time, and we're still pretty poor, but in 2008 we had a solid gold rating, and we borrowed a lot of money just in time for the entire economy of the world to go in the toilet. So as long as the bank lets us stay in our house, we live in a nice house. And I finally thought my wife has been, she's been very sweet. She's worked hard as a physical therapist and as a mom. And finally, she'd like a nice living room. And we can, for once in our lives, we'll get a nice living room. So we have this nice living room. And the couches are the way they're supposed to be. And the lamps are the way they're supposed to be. And hardwood's in. And it's a nice, it's not big. It's not fancy by California standards. Pretty drab. But it's still pretty nice. Now, when you have a perfect living room and your six-year-old nephew comes over to visit, what you don't say is, subdue it. Right? That's not what you say. Say, don't touch anything. In fact, come on over here where grandma has some toys, right? That's what you say, if your nephew or your uncle, whatever it is. You don't want anybody messing with your beautiful, perfect living room. But God doesn't say that to us, because it's a beautiful world, but it's wild. And God intends for us to cultivate it, to have dominion over it the way a gardener has dominion over her garden. And in fact, it's even more powerful than that, because in this case, the gardener is part of the garden. I mean, we're in a symbiotic relationship with the world. So when God says, be lords over the world, subdue it, have dominion, he means the way I am toward the world. Not in an exploitative way, but be little lords toward the world in the image of God. Which means we are supposed to be toward the world the way God is toward the world. And God isn't exploitative. God doesn't rape the earth. God cares for the earth. God tends the earth. God gives of himself to the earth. Be toward the world as the gardener is toward her garden. In a symbiotic relationship and a responsible relationship and a creative relationship. With what? With global shalom as the goal. The flourishing of every element of the garden and every relationship in the garden and every social complex in the garden, that everything may thrive. That's the vision. The vision is not exploiting the rest of creation for our good, as if a gardener, now I'm not talking about a hobby gardener and the way certain gardens are that we get to enjoy in the middle class West. I'm talking about serious gardens where you're depending on it, like the garden that a farm family may have, and that's where their vegetables are going to come from, right? That's where they're going to eat. The way you treat that garden is the way we're supposed to treat the garden. A subsistence garden, a garden we live in, a garden that we rely upon so that we want everything to flourish, because then we'll flourish. And if we flourish temporarily at the expense of the garden, we will be dead soon. It's just as stark as that. God places us in this situation. So the cultural mandate is basically the answer to the question of ecological responsibility. And it shows us that Lynn White, in his famous essay, misread the Bible he was looking at. And many others, who aren't as smart as Lynn White, have really misread it, as if to say that Genesis is telling us that the world is our playpen, as if we're a bunch of chubby, overfed, overindulged kids that we can just kind of wreck our toys at our own, you know, amusement, and then we'll just get more toys added in. That's not the picture. The picture is of creatures created in the image of God to do God's work in the world, to creatively till it, to make shalom. And with that vision, not only is there no grounds for Christian exploitation, but there's every ground we need for an appropriate response to the Christian, to the world. But if we look at the end of the Bible, as well as at the beginning of the Bible, Christian eschatology, the doctrine of the last things, we see that the world to come is a new planet. It's called a new heavens and a new earth. But that's exactly the language of Genesis 1, the beginning, right? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, right? Which means the skies and the earth. And what, you know, it was this planet and its ecosystem. And Christian eschatology says, in the last couple of chapters of the Bible, and behold, I saw the new Jerusalem descending from heaven to earth, and it is a new heavens and new earth. It's deliberately echoing the language of Genesis 1. This planet is our home. As we discussed somewhat humorously yesterday, we're not going up to heaven as disembodied souls. That is not a Christian vision. The Christian vision is not going up to heaven. It's going forward to a renewed planet with resurrected bodies. And this planet, like us, will be new. Well, it says it's a new heavens and a new earth. That's right. But not brand new. The language of newness in the New Testament is not the language of radical discontinuity. I hope not. Because if the new heaven and new earth are radically new, then I won't be there either. So I'm really glad it's not radically discontinuous. Because I want to go forward into it. I want you to be able to go forward into it. I want my kin to be able to go forward into it. I want everything that's good in this world to go forward into it. So it's not brand new, as if there's a complete break and then God starts everything else ex nihilo. Instead, it's renewed. Everything is freshened up and rehabilitated and now flourishing the way it's supposed to. This, to me, wonderful vision, which I regret I was not taught as a kid in church, and that I had to go on to graduate school to learn other places. This vision, which is right there in the last two chapters of the Bible, if only I'd had the right lenses through which to see it. This wonderful vision gives us, I think, very powerful alternatives to some of the ecological, ideological options of our day. It offers an alternative to what we would call the ahimsa of Jainism. Jain is a very small religion from India. Those of you from India know about it, but most of the rest of us don't. But in the Jain religion, one of the main doctrines is ahimsa, doing no harm. You might recognize the term because Gandhi appropriated it from Jain. And in Jainism, or Jain, ahimsa means literally doing no harm to any other creature. And the really super spiritual Jains reduce their diet so that they're eating less and less. They're actually ingesting fewer and fewer of the planet's creatures until they finally live on water alone and then die of starvation. And that way, they are doing as little harm as possible. I mean, that they're really serious about this, to the point that self-sacrifice by starvation is the highest form of Jain piety. Well, Christianity says that's going too far. That's not what you need to do. God does not ask us to garden the world by having the smallest footprint possible, because the smallest footprint possible is no footprint, is not being here. And it's not, this Christian vision is not the vision of deep ecology. It's not the vision of Peter Singer. It's not the vision of contemporary people who will say, in Singer's powerful phrase, that a boy is a dog, is a rat. I mean, it's not that. Saying there are ecological relationships we want to respect, but it's not simply a matter of everything's kind of on the same level and we have no business consuming anything else. It also offers an alternative to the otherworldliness of mysticisms that have no responsibility for the planet. They're just going to enjoy connecting with the great beyond, and in cultures that are strongly influenced by mysticism, there isn't much ecological responsibility. things just kind of roll on because we're too busy trying to get right with the spiritual sphere. Christianity says, no, actually, garbage is a spiritual concern. Ecological devastation is a spiritual concern. Old growth tree cutting is a spiritual concern because God, our great spirit, loves the whole world. And this is our home forever. It also offers an alternative to any focus on this world as merely something to use or even something to fear. Right? The old gospel song, "This world is not my home, I'm just a passing through," is a lot more fun to sing than it is to think about. Because it's just wrong. This world is our home. We are passing through only to come back to this world in its new state, in a properly functioning ecosystem in concert with God who comes down to dwell with us. And so it seems to me that Christians, rather than being worried about ecology or worried about the environmental movement, actually have something very powerful and helpful to say in concert with appropriate ecological concern. That's one of the reasons I'm still a Christian, is that I think I don't have to pick one or the other, but that Christianity helps ground an appropriate environmental responsibility as well. Come on up and we'll take some questions now, and I'll throw some resources up here for you in terms of reading and websites, but we've got a few minutes for some Q&A now.
We've got about 20 minutes here for questions, so we'll start up here, and Bernard will be in back, and we'll kind of ping pong back and forth.
Well, thank you very thank you very much. Is that turned on?
Yeah, it is. We can hear you.
Oh, stand up. Okay. Well, thank you very much for your talk on science and Christianity. Earlier in the talk, you alluded to some arguments that could be used in favor of Christianity from basically a natural or scientific perspective. I wonder if you might like to sketch the gist of one or two of those, of your favorites.
Yeah, I think in the sense of science here, we have to use the appropriate discipline to get at the appropriate concern. And Christianity, unlike some other religions and philosophies, is a strongly history-based religion and outlook. So in fact, for us, even though there have been arguments in classical Christian history, arguments from design, arguments from the so-called teleological and cosmological arguments, and those still are brought forward, but by looking at the way the universe is designed and looking at things like the anthropic principle, particularly in its strong form, that the world, in other words, in the cosmos is created with such incredibly small tolerances and such incredible mutual interactions of all sorts of numbers and relationships and so on, that the odds against that happening by mere chance are unfathomable. I mean, the numbers are just too big for that to even be considered. Now, that's outside the realm of my own technical expertise, and I'm waiting for the experts to fight it out a bit, and then once they sorted that out, then I'm happy to use it. But I can only understand that as a scientific layperson. But I am impressed that people who have scientific credentials are impressed by that kind of thinking, particularly stronger anthropic principle arguments, and the philosophers who enjoy thrashing out the cosmological argument that the world is such that it seems to be incapable of self-generation. The universe, in other words, can't be explained in terms of just coming into existence. This is a lot easier argument to make after we all agreed on the Big Bang since the 1960s. And about 20-some years later, there was some discussion in cosmology about an oscillating universe, so maybe it's eternal, Big Bang, Big Crunch, Big Bang, Big Crunch, and that seems not to be the case either. But as somebody who's done a little work in the history of science, I'm reluctant to load up too much on those arguments because our view of cosmology has changed so radically just in my lifetime that I don't want to build a strong case for Christianity on current cosmology, which will, you know, probably be outdated by tomorrow afternoon. You see what I'm saying about that? So I'm interested in those arguments. If they appeal to you, that's great. But frankly, the rational arguments for Christianity focus much more on the history, on whether we can believe that the biblical accounts of what happened in the past, particularly around the career of Jesus, are reasonably reliable. Now notice what I'm claiming. Not that they are the very word of God come from heaven. Just are they reasonably reliable accounts of what Jesus said and did? And if they are, and I think it is actually fairly easy to show that they are reasonably reliable, then you end up with events, particularly the apparent resurrection of Jesus, or at least the empty tomb, and the behavior of Jesus' early followers following that, that are massively important in world history. I mean, some kind of bomb went off about 2,000 years ago in Israel that resulted in the world's largest social movement ever, the Christian religion. So something happened back there, and it's worth trying to figure out what cause would be proportionate to the effect. And it's in those historical realms I think we can ask some appropriate questions. But that's getting me going on something I've written a couple books on, so I'll keep it to that for now. But thank you very much for asking.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, thank you for your message, and I really appreciate it. And I also totally agree with what you addressed today. I have two questions, but to save time, I just mention one question first. The first question that I think today there's a lot of a conflict between religion, especially Christianity religion, with science. Actually, it not comes from the fundamental belief, but technically they come from the relationship between these two areas. Especially we look at the past 200 years. It comes from the, from my point of view, how the believer interpret the Bible, especially the Genesis chapter 1 to 11, and they impose their interpretation to the rest of the world. So it creates a reaction or rebound, especially on the area of biology or cosmetology. So I view, you know, that's kind of a lot of a responsibility from Christian itself.
Yeah.
This is my first question. How do you look at this, especially the interpretation of the Genesis?
I think one of the, as a historian of evangelical and Protestant Christianity, which is my original training, I would say that one of the understandable but regrettable developments in the history of Christianity in the West over the last 150 years is that we have reacted the way groups tend to react when they're embattled. And when a group feels threatened, and it's threatened, it's never threatened globally on every front. It's always threatened on one or two or three or a certain number of fronts. You then concentrate your defenses on those embattled places. And then, because those are the embattled places, and you may not have chosen those to be the places in which you want to fight, they may not be your most important views, but because that's where the enemy's attacking, that little gate that didn't really matter before now becomes the focus of the war. And it has to be. But then you can lose perspective and think that everything's about the gate. And in fact, your whole identity is as a gate defender. Whereas in fact, you've got this beautiful gate out front, which is really the main point. But because the enemy's coming over here, you can now start to so focus on that that becomes the marker of your loyalty and identity, is whether you focus all your attention on that gate, whether everybody else inside focuses on the gate as well. And we have tended to do that because one of the places in which modern learning has put stress on us is on the question of cosmology and paleontology. We have then not only responded to that, we have over-responded, so to speak, and now we have made it a badge of Christian fidelity as to whether you look at the gate the way we do and defend it the way we do, or you're simply not for us, you're against us, which is exactly how you feel when you're at war, right? And if when you're embattled, things do become narrow, and they become absolute, and they become all or nothing. And it's time for us to, like, I think, in a sense, calm down a bit and pull back and see the big picture of our faith. And in particular, not to let a particular reading, whatever it might be, of Genesis become the single most important thing about fidelity, or not making an all or nothing campaign. And secondly, I would say, we have forgotten what we used to know as Christians, which is that God wrote the book of nature as well as the book of Scripture, and that everything we know about the world is a gift of God. Not just what we know from the Bible. Everything we know from science is a gift of God. Everything we know from poetry is a gift of God. Everything we know from our spouse is a gift of God. Like, everything is a gift of God. And so while we were defending the Bible because it was under such tremendous attack, we ended up with, again, the narrow, frightened vision, and now we were just Bible-only people. But Christians aren't Bible-only people. Christians are Christian people who follow Jesus Christ. We don't follow a book. I love the Bible. I've got old-fashioned views about the Bible. I think it's the Word of God written. I think it's infallible in every respect. But you know what? I follow the Bible because it's Jesus' book, not because it's the perfect book. I'm not a Muslim. It's not the Quran. It's the Bible. And so I'm open to being informed by God about how I should read the Bible from all of the things that I think he's telling me, just as I'm open to thinking about science from what I think he's telling me in the Bible. It's a dialectical, grateful relationship. That's where I think it seems to me to be healthier for us to do our thinking.
Okay. Thank you. Can I ask the second question?
If it's pretty brief, sure.
Yeah. Very short.
Especially if it's easy.
it's of course easy. Yeah, you talk about the tension, all the tension between our religion and the environmentalist. Okay, I came from the Buddhism background. Okay, they most of them are vegetarian, Hinduism or vegetarian. But in Bible, you know, after the flood, we are allowed to eat animal.
Yeah.
So that created a lot of tension, because they we treated those animal a secondary creature. And we use them as our resource. But in the Revelation, you know, when there's a new Jerusalem, new heaven, actually the lion and the lamb, they live together without harming each other. So how do you look at this, carnival, you know?
Okay. Yeah.
Humans carnival, you know?
Yeah, he's asking about the fact that other beliefs, other religions are vegetarian, and that in the scripture it seems to me that human beings originally were vegetarian. We don't know for sure, but it seems to me that God says, I give you every green plant for food and so on. And after the flood, Noah is explicitly given animals to eat as well. And interestingly, by the way, in Acts 10, Peter is actually given unclean animals to eat also. So in fact, in the New Testament, you see an even broader license to eat animals, even though the symbolism's about something else. He is actually asked to kill and eat, and it's animals he's given to kill and eat. So meat eating apparently is okay, it seems to me, for Christians. I realize that there's lots of other moral questions about factory farming and the bad treatment of animals, and that does, in fact, show up in the Christian ethical matrix. We should care about that. In other words, if you can't find a way to eat meat that doesn't involve the ridiculous suffering of animals, then maybe you need to be vegetarian. I mean, that's a genuine option, and it should be an option we consider. But what about the world to come? You know, in the world to come, are we going to eat meat or not? And I can definitively tell you that I don't know. I read the same passage as you do, and I don't know, a lion lies down with a lamb, but is a lion that's no longer carnivorous still a lion? I don't know. What does it look like? What does his dentition turn into? I mean, what kind of stomach does he now have? Because he seems right now to need to eat meat in order for his system to work. But I really don't know, and I'm looking forward to finding out.
Back to his first question. As an educator, I received this email today, and I'd just like to know what your response would be, okay?
Sure.
Dear friend, the Texas Taliban, also known as the right-wing majority of the Texas State Board of Education, want to revise the state standards for science textbooks to require the addition of religious pseudoscience when teaching subjects like biology. And this isn't just bad news for Texas school children, because Texas standards will impact the textbooks used by millions of students nationwide. Will you join me in fighting this outrageous abuse of power?
Well, there's nothing like a little calm deliberation to nicely frame the issues for us there. The devil's in the details, and God's in the details there too. Like, what are we really talking about? And the problem is, there's so much smoke around there, I can't really tell what's happening. So, is six-day creationism being mandated to be taught as truth in American public schools? Is that the question? Probably not. If it is, that's problematic in one way. Is intelligent design in a very chastened, reduced sort that's purged of its religion as far as it can go, so that a supreme creative agent is being posited as a way of explaining certain scientific phenomena that otherwise seem incapable of rational explanation by purely natural means, which is what I think intelligent design is at its most chaste. That to me is different. And I simply think it's been a category mistake in the American courts and in the American media to simply call intelligent design creationism or creation science by another name. I just think they just either don't know what they're talking about or they're deliberately blending the two together to get rid of them both. Because I think there's a number of aspects. As a historian, I would say that that's exactly what I want to say about the phenomenon of the resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth, is that there's a hole in the rational record that needs an explanation, and I think the best way to explain that phenomenon is that God raised Jesus from the dead, rather than Jesus spontaneously resurrected, or that the disciples knew something about resurrection that we don't know, or there, in other words, there's not a naturalistic explanation for that, there's a divine explanation, it's the only one that makes sense. That may be true in biology as well. It may be that the leap from non-life to life needs divine energy to be added to the system. Oh, you can't get from non-life to life. Or my biology friends tell me that another huge gap is between a single-cell organism and multi-cell organism, that that's a giant leap, and that there's no way that current science at least can explain how you get from multi-cell to single-cell. Or even the eukaryotic cell itself. Like, how do you get all these little organisms to work within a single cell in a symbiotic relationship? Well, I don't think that we should pose God and shut down scientific inquiry. I also think at the same time, don't not include God if that's a reasonable possibility. So there is a way in which intelligent design can, I think, be integrated into science teaching that also, for one thing, would make science instruction more interesting. Because one of the worst things about science instruction is the way it's done in our schools, which is, this is the truth, write it down, give it back to me on the exam. Well, who would ever want to be a scientist? But instead you say, you know what? We don't know everything. Science is still exploring things. We have arguments about it all the time. And I find it interesting that not only Alvin Plantinga, but Neil Postman both advocated the teaching of intelligent design in the classrooms just to spark interest, just because it would help us understand that science is in fact in motion. And what's happened now in the culture struggles you have down here is that almost everybody who is inclined toward evolutionary beliefs feels they have to maintain a kind of solidarity against all the religious nuts. And all the Bible believers who may not agree with each other on six-day literal creation or on day age or on six epochs or on even theistic evolution, we feel obliged to close ranks because other things are at stake, so it's become a very polarized situation. But happily not yet the Taliban. By the way, you know what Taliban means? It's actually the word for Bible school student. I love that. It means seminarian. And having taught in some of those places, I totally get that. Okay. There's nobody righter than somebody who's had a year of theological training.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question.
There's one about halfway back here, John.
So it's an interesting coincidence that you mentioned Alvin Plantinga, because my question actually concerns one of his recent books, I think his most recent book. So he expounds on this. His argument is essentially that the conflict is essentially between, not between science and religion, but rather the conflict is really between science and naturalism. And essentially, my understanding of the argument is that on naturalism, it's quite probable that our rational faculties are simply unreliable because evolution does not select for logical thoughts. However, on Christianity, the mind is distinct from the brain, essentially, and so that there isn't this problem. So I'm just curious what your evaluation of this argument is.
Well, basically, I actually snuck it into my own argument. I mean, I was basically paraphrasing Al Plantinga when I talked about the fact that evolution is not a truth-seeking... It's not original to Al anyway, but I mean, his book is the most recent exposition of this idea, right? Evolution doesn't select for truth-seeking unless it's evolutionarily advantageous or selectively advantageous. Now, I think, actually, I've had dialogue with Al Plantinga about this when the book was in its earlier forms as essays. I thought he over-argued a little bit, because if you have a brain that doesn't give you reasonably reliable information about the world, you're going to be selectively disadvantaged, right? You're going to be dead soon if you're not processing the world reasonably accurately. So I sometimes think in some of the earlier versions, he tended to oversimplify things a little bit. I say that carefully, because Al Plantinga is about 100 times smarter than I am. But still, it seemed to me he overdid it a bit. He's more careful in this book now. And there, again, I think he's basically reiterating that argument, that there doesn't seem to be any good reason on strict Darwinian grounds to believe that these great theories that we spin out with our overdeveloped brains are actually true, because there's no evolutionarily advantageous reason to believe that this kind of theory spinning will help me have more kids, right? It's not selectively advantageous.
Well, I'm going to end our evening, our formal evening now. Thank you, John. Appreciate
it. Thank
you. And obviously, your talk sparks a lot of good conversation, and it gets us out of our boxes, gets us thinking, and it's a wonderful thing. So thanks for coming. Again, tomorrow night we'll be here at 7 o'clock and take up the topic of the world and its sexual ideas as opposed to Christianity, and that should be another engaging evening.